This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll speak with Stephen Salida about his new book, Uncivil Rights, Palestine and the Limits of Academic Freedom.
Professor Salida has come a long way. A year ago, he was jobless, as was his wife, had no insurance for his family, and was looking at a difficult lawsuit. Things have now changed.
We'll talk about a report hot off the presses, The Palestine Exception to Free Speech, a movement under attack in the U.S.
Fearful of a shift in domestic public opinion, Israel's fiercest defenders in the United States are attacking campus activists. This report documents what they're doing and how they may not succeed.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Mustey Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Just before he was to start teaching last year at the University of Illinois in the American Indian Studies program, Professor Stephen Salida was abruptly fired. His firing was a consequence of a number of tweets that he posted criticizing the Israeli conduct of their war in Gaza. An enormous public outcry followed the scholar's firing, with thousands petitioning for his reinstatement and 5,000 professors pledging to boycott the University of Illinois. The Salida case raises significant questions regarding the First Amendment and joint faculty administrative governance. In his just-published book, Uncivil Rights, Palestine and the Limits of Academic Freedom, Professor Salida brings personal reflection and political critique to bear on his high-profile and controversial termination. He deftly positions his case at the intersection of important issues affecting higher education and social justice activism. Stephen Salida now holds the Edward W. Said Chair of American Studies at the American University of Beirut. He's the author of 6 books, a columnist for Electronic Intifada, and a member of the organizing committee of the U.S. Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel.
Stephen, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me back.
Now, for our listeners who may not be as familiar with your case as we are, in a nutshell, tell us why you were fired.
Yeah, during the summer of 2014, this is during Israel's so-called Operation Protective Edge. It's a heavy bombardment of the Gaza Strip. I had sent a series of tweets condemning those actions, condemning the Israeli government, and also condemning those who were supporting Operation Protective Edge, various political figures, and it caught the attention of some right-wing websites, those tweets did, and it ended up generating a small controversy. And then really kind of out of nowhere, I received a letter terminating my employment contract from the University of Illinois, where I was scheduled to begin exactly two weeks later. And so that firing ended up creating a lot of controversy and discussion. I subsequently filed a suit against the university for violations of the First and 14th Amendment. So that suit is ongoing, and really in many ways the controversy is ongoing too.
I want to talk about the issue of incivility, and specifically read a tweet you sent out on July 19th, 2014. Mm-hmm. You wrote, "At this point, if Netanyahu appeared on TV with a necklace made from the teeth of Palestinian children, would anyone be surprised?" Mm-hmm. And tell us what happened after you tweeted that.
Well, actually, nothing happened after I tweeted it, but it was held up a little bit later on as an example of incivility and used as the basis for accusations of anti-Semitism. So that tweet, I think, probably more than any other one, has earned a certain sort of notoriety.
Yeah, the irony is that at that point, the Israelis had already murdered 300 Palestinian children. They were going on to murder over 500. and altogether over 2,000 civilians. In that context, when they say you're not civil and you're an anti-Semite, there's a lot of irony there. Talk to us about that. You were hired as a professor in the Indian Studies Department, mm-hmm. and the allegation of incivility against Native Americans is something we all know about. Even ironically, the allegation of incivility against Jews in my parents' generation. Talk to us about, in the white settler state context, what incivility has meant.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's very often used tacitly as a means to browbeat people into political conformity, and that's very often its rhetorical function. But it as you point out, it has a particular history that is quite ugly in projects of settler colonization, particularly here on the North American continent. It's a rationale for, you know, calling a people uncivilized or uncivil is a way to create a rationale for occupying them, displacing them, or undertaking various civilizing missions against them. And I feel like it at least, again, implicitly puts human beings into different moral and ontological hierarchies and says that this group of people is more advanced or superior than this group of people, and therefore has some sort of right to you know, enact its power on behalf of the lesser group.
Your situation, if you'll pardon the phrase, the worm has turned, Stephen. A year ago, you were out on your rear end, no job. Your wife had left her job. You had no home. You had no health insurance. Your little boy had no health insurance. Christopher Kennedy, the head of the Board of Trustees at the University of Illinois, said, "We don't want to hurt the guy, but we don't want him around here." And they really did hurt you. And now you're on your feet. And I wanted to ask you to talk about your new job, the defense committee behind you, the victories in the lawsuit. I mean, things are 100% turned around from the way they were a year ago. And, you know, tell us how you feel about it and what's going on.
Sure. Yeah, things are definitely different right now than they were, let's say, at this point a year ago. But I don't want to rain on the parade of victories, but, you know, still, you know, Christopher Kennedy has not faced any sort of sanction, you know, at this point. You know, nothing has happened to him based on his involvement. So many people who were involved in making the decision have at this point not faced any consequences for their action. I'm only in a 1 year visiting professorship, so there's still a lot of work to be done, I think, both individually and communally. And I think the great point of victory will be reached when it's impossible for these sorts of things to happen again.
Let's talk briefly about what the judge said about the First Amendment implications in your case. Mm-hmm. There was a motion to dismiss, and the judge has ruled that your case can proceed. Yeah. And he had some strong words to say.
Very strong words. Yeah, he I'm paraphrasing. I don't want to misquote the judge. So let me make it clear. It's a paraphrase. And if somebody remembers actual phrase, feel free to jump in. But he basically declared that if the university's rationale held, then academic hiring as we currently know it would cease to exist. Right? That the very structure of academe and academic hiring would collapse if the university's behavior somehow became accepted as a norm. And he also completely rejected the argument, and it was always an insidious argument, and it was always a dishonest argument, that I wasn't actually hired. Right?
And then he said, with respect to the First Amendment, he said, this case implicates every aspect of the First Amendment.
That's right. Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. Yeah.
Didn't someone resign as a result of this?
Yeah, there were two resignations. One, the chancellor who, you know, I guess I don't want to use the verb orchestrated this, because she was one among many who were involved, but she was kind of the public face of it. Phyllis Weiss, she ended up resigning under some pretty ignoble circumstances. And then the second in command, the chief academic officer, Ide Adesida, the provost, ended up stepping down shortly thereafter.
What kind of circumstances?
Well, I don't know if your listeners or how many of your listeners have had the opportunity to look up the email dump that came as a result of FOIA inquiries, right? And then, of course, we had to take the university to court, you know, to get them to release those documents. And those documents showed, I don't know, how would you describe it, Michael? It's kind of it shows a circus of a lot of things.
It shows that. She didn't want this stuff to come out, so instead of using the normal University of Illinois email channels, she did a Hillary Clinton. She did it on her own private account, and it came out anyway. Yeah. So that forced her to resign. But
did they suggest that they were indebted to other funders? What was the thrust of the communiques?
From the ones I've read, and Stephen knows more than I do, but they were suggestive that she was orchestrating this whole firing of Stephen, illegal firing. And so she resigned, but she got a $400,000 bonus, which had been in her contract. And it was such a scandal in the state of Illinois, which is having budget problems, that the governor said, we won't let her resign, we're firing her. So they fired her, and she lost the $400,000. So we'll see. She said one of her statements that she was only carrying water for Christopher Kennedy,
that's right,
the head of the Board of Trustees. So I think the depositions, which are going forward now in the wake of the loss of the motion to dismiss, are going to be juicy.
Yeah. One interesting result of the email releases, and I really, really urge whoever happens to be listening to check them out. It makes for some pretty sordid and interesting reading. It's kind of a sneak preview into how the sausage is made, right? Of governance, right? And it's just as ugly as you would imagine it to be. Originally the judge dismissed our complaint of spoliation. Right, or the spoiling of evidence. Then the emails came out, and the judge put it back in.
Some of the information we can gather from these emails, you reproduce in a chapter from your book. And let me just remind our listeners, we're interviewing Stephen Salida, Professor Stephen Salida, who's once again a professor. And he has just come out with a book called Uncivil Rights, Palestine and the Limits of Academic Freedom. He's teaching in Beirut now. He's back here in New York on a tour to promote the book. It's a really fine book. So let's talk some more about the book. Stephen, halfway through the book, and at this point you're unemployed, you haven't spoken to anybody, and there's a press conference. And you go to the press conference with Maria LaHood and Anandswamy Nathan. You're a little nervous, and usually don't get nervous when you speak publicly. On this one, you are. You write about the experience in the book, and I thought this was one of the nice passages. And I'm going to ask you if you would please read it for us.
Oh, I would be honored to. Thank you. An hour later, we were ushered into the YMCA auditorium through the kitchen of a Chinese restaurant housed in the building. I was stunned when we entered the auditorium from a side door leading to the dais. A huge crowd stood and chanted, "Reinstate Salida." The space was packed to capacity. Many others stood outside of the auditorium in the foyer. Dozens of reporters occupied the front few rows. Lights flashed from expensive cameras perched atop tripods. I knew in that moment we would win this battle. I smiled and waved. I was drenched from the steady rain on the four-block walk from the car to the building. In pictures, I look afflicted by irregular splotches of sweat.
Stephen, we know the vast support that you have received over this past year. I want to ask, though, have you had critics publicly or privately approach you, and what's that been like?
Yeah, it's probably it is among the most unpleasant facets of this experience, I guess if you could call it an experience, of this phenomenon, I think is the word to use now. There are plenty of my colleagues in academe, you know, who continue to criticize my tweets or continue to criticize my politics. They, you know, my scholarship. People were starting to dig around in my family history. You know, Carrie Nelson, who's been writing against me for about a year, published a 14,000 word article, supposedly showing that my scholarship is below par. You know, so these sorts of things happen. And then, of course, you know, then I deal with the what so many activists in this area are aware of, familiar with, and have experienced themselves, like sort of the constant barrage of invective. Very often, racist and violent invective that arises from, you know, I guess certain corners, and I'm being generous by saying corners, certain corners of the pro-Israel establishment.
Although last night when you spoke at NYU Law School, I think people were afraid that there might be disruption, and the master of ceremonies had to give a little talk about how you shouldn't disrupt him. But there was no disruption at all. And contrast that to years ago, if you tried to speak about Israel's behavior, you'd get shouted down. That happened to me personally at Rutgers Law School. Mm-hmm. So I think that the tide has turned a little bit anyway. Yeah. Stephen, one of the delightful chapters in your book was your incivility manifesto. And I wanted to ask you if you might read from the incivility manifesto, because I think it'll give us some inspiration and guidance.
Oh, I would be happy to. Just as a foregrounding, there was an article that somebody published called A Civility Manifesto, and this is kind of a response to that of sorts. One, we critically examine all definitional commonplaces. Two, we maintain an antagonistic relationship with administrators when they sell our institutions to outside donors and corporate interests. Three, we oppose the exploitation of contingent labor. Four, we challenge explicit or implicit racism, homophobia, sexism, transphobia, ableism, and classism wherever we encounter them. Five, we believe students are learners, not consumers. Six, we maintain that education should supersede the profit motive. Seven, we consider the free market a lazy rationale for bloated administrative salaries. Eight, we decolonize rather than authenticate academic spaces. Nine, we reject diversity and seek actual representation instead. And 10, we demand justice for victims of sexual assault and the banishment of their perpetrators and administrative enablers. So that's I guess the first 10 commandments of the incivility manifesto.
That leads me into the next question, and it's something that you describe as the neoliberal university.
Yeah.
And that's something I think that we really should talk about, because universities have changed. You quote Thomas Frank in your article about how the endowments of the major universities are now run as hedge funds.
Yes.
There was an op-ed in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago that said that actually the fees that these people that run the endowments as hedge funds make mm-hmm. are actually more than the money that's given to students in scholarships at the major universities.
Yes.
So things have changed right out from under us, and your case certainly shines a spotlight on that. So talk to us about, what is a neoliberal university?
Sure. Yeah, you did a wonderful job of sort of foregrounding that definition. You know, so we're sitting right in the vicinity of NYU, and it's a great institution, and it has fantastic faculty. I have like
I
a lot of,
out of NYU.
Did you? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's another mark against it. it would be even better had you been able to call yourself an alum. But you know, and I have a lot of terrific colleagues there. But it's very often it seems like NYU is a real estate company, right, in the guise of a university. And that would be one very explicit example of the neoliberal university. Sometimes it's called the corporate university, sometimes the imperial university. And these terms all have different shades of meaning, but they generally refer to the same thing, and that's to the phenomenon of universities being run overtly as corporations. Students get seen as consumers. They look to attract a certain demographic to the school. So for public universities, they want out-of-state students who can afford the full out-of-state tuition. They don't receive significant public funding anymore, so therefore they become more beholden to private donors, and private donors don't give money to institutions and then sit back and, you know, let them do their thing. They always have strings attached, either overtly or covertly. And they're also deeply invested, many of these universities, in military apparatuses, in research that's being used for militarization, for weapons development, you know, and corporations have an increasing presence on campus. Students are very often subject to predatory, you know, loan schemes, you know. So in other words, a lot of, I'm speaking particularly of public universities, like the University of Illinois and Iowa and North Carolina, these grand old public research institutions that have really, really tremendous histories and have been tremendous assets to the residents of their states. They're moving away from the idea of education as a public good, and they're really moving towards the idea of a top-down authoritative governing structure that puts emphasis on raising money and all of the conformity that that entails, rather than, you know, the practices of critical thinking, the practices of learning and all of the discomfort that those practices traditionally entail.
Stephen, I have two questions. The first is, during the deposition phase and your forthcoming trial, if additional information comes out about practices on the university level that we would find repugnant, in addition to sort of the immediate ones of maybe not wanting to offend funders, what do you hope will come out as a result? Do you hope for systemic changes in policy on the university level?
Yes, at the university level, in a broad sense, not specific to the University of Illinois, although that's kind of the primary institution of concern. I hope very much that people who have rallied around this and similar cases keep pushing until we begin to reverse and ultimately eliminate these trends towards corporatization, until, you know, and I hope people feel empowered and emboldened to hold tight, you know, and to get to a point where they too can expose some of the corruption, you know, that's endemic to upper level governance at so many of these places. So yeah, the ultimate goal, you know, beyond resolving my own I guess personal issues with the university, is to maintain or retain or reclaim democratic governance, to reclaim the campus for the purpose of education and not for, you know, fundraising or not for the ideological playground of private donors.
We're speaking with Professor Stephen Salida, whose recent book, Uncivil Rights, Palestine and the Limits of Academic Freedom, is now available. It's a very fine book. Stephen, tell us how things are going now with you personally and politically. What can we expect is going to happen with respect to your case? And tell us about your life now that you amazingly got a very good job, not in the United States, but in Lebanon. Tell us what that's like, and then what your plans are and what politically is going to happen, as you hope, in the near future.
Sure. Yeah, I've you know, it's I've gotten back to the classroom, which has been a beautiful experience. I'm getting time to work on my scholarship again. I'm eager, as are a lot of people, I think, to see what ultimately happens with the case, what more information will come to light, and then how that information is processed and handled. You know, I think everybody is suspects that the information that comes out is not necessarily going to be flattering, and so, you know, based on how every bit of information that's been released up to this point has looked. Politically, I'm still working on the things that are important to me. BDS, academic freedom, the suppression of Palestine activism. I was really happy to see the recent report by the CCR and Palestine Legal that documented cases of suppression within the past 2 years. I think it's very important work, but it tells us the extraordinary form of power that we're up against, and I plan to remain active in the communities that are fighting against this sort of suppression.
I understand that the American Indian Studies Department at the University of Illinois has held your line open. So would you like to go back and teach there? And how's that department doing now that it's been reduced because of what they did to you?
Right. Sure. You know, if there's even a department to go back to. So, your final question about the state of the department is really depressing. I would have been faculty member number 8. And, you know, they always have postdocs and you know, so it's a pretty small but very lively space, intellectual space. They're down to 1.5 faculty members. And so if those who are not familiar with academia, the 0.5 doesn't refer to half a human, but somebody who's 50% of his line is in American Indian Studies and 50% is in English. So he sort of splits time between both departments. So the department has really been ravaged. It's been made clear that so many of the decision makers at the university don't care about the department, right? They, you know, the fact of the matter is, first of all, they took this decision, and it wasn't just a decision against me; it was a decision against the American Indian Studies program. But second of all, Robert Warrior, the chair of American Indian Studies, had to reach out to Phyllis Wise in December in order to get a meeting with her. She never approached the department to even talk to them about this.
Yeah, even though it was the department that vetted you and hired you.
Exactly.
And then you were fired over their head. Mm-hmm. So what was the period of time that the department was so diminished from 7 or 8 people down to 1.5?
A few people, from what I understand, moved their lines into other departments. And one of the reasons to that... So tenure is not foolproof, as obviously as my case illustrates, but there are ways that tenured professors can be fired. And one of the main, besides misconduct, if a department gets shut down or a program gets canceled altogether, right, then tenure generally doesn't protect you anymore. And so there was a worry, I think, that the entire department would get shut down. And so they moved their lines into other departments, you know, English, history, anthropology, et cetera, as a form of stability. But also at least 2 faculty members I know have taken jobs at the University of Minnesota, Twin Cities. You know, so people either move their lines or they're leaving or have left altogether.
Yeah, so this is really an attack not only on you but the department and about letters and science generally.
Exactly.
Is there a website where our listeners can go to look at some of those letters that came out as a result of the FOIA requests?
Yeah, I think the Center of Constitutional Rights is a good place to look. Or I don't want to drive any traffic to the Champaign-Urbana News Gazette. But, you know, if they Google Salita FOIA emails, FOIA emails, a bunch of links will come up. They were posted all over the internet.
Good. And we'll link to it on lawanddisorder.org as well. You dedicate the book to For He Who Ignites. Mm-hmm. Talk about that.
Well, it's both a direct and oblique reference to my son, and it is meant to to address anybody who has that sort of fire inside of them to do something. Work on somehow making this very corrupt and inequitable world a little bit better, you know. So people who carry that flame inside of them, and if anybody reads the book, and I hope very much that they read it, they'll see that my relationship with my son is a pretty significant theme that runs throughout the story.
In you, Stephen, your son has a wonderful role model.
Oh, thank you very much. I hope so. I think often about him growing up and hearing about the story, and that's always my guiding, decision-making form. You know, I want him, no matter what happens to me, I want him to be able to say, I'm proud of my old man.
Well, we're proud of you, Stephen, and it's, as always, a pleasure to have you on.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
We've been talking with Professor Stephen Salita, whose new book's just out, Uncivil Rights, Palestine and the Limits of Academic Freedom, a very important book. Stephen, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
new report, The Palestine Exception to Free Speech, a movement under attack in the U.S., released by Palestine Legal and the Center for Constitutional Rights, documents for the first time the widespread and growing suppression of Palestinian human rights advocacy in the U.S. A companion video features students and scholars discussing the backlash they've experienced for engaging in Palestine advocacy. Palestine Legal, a nonprofit dedicated to protecting the civil rights of people in the U.S., responded to nearly 300 incidents over an 18-month period. 85% of the incidents, which included baseless legal complaints, administrative disciplinary actions, firings, harassments, and false accusations of terrorism and anti-Semitism, targeted students and scholars. Driven by a network of Israel advocacy organizations, these efforts target the movement for Palestinian rights in the U.S., which has grown significantly over the last decade. The report includes case studies and testimony from advocates targeted for their speech. It outlines a notable increase in federal and state legislative efforts to condemn or restrict advocacy for Palestinian human rights, including legislation that conflates criticism of Israel policy with anti-Semitism. Joining us to talk about this is attorney Dima Khalidi, director of Palestine Legal.
Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Dima, you've helped produce this excellent report called The Palestinian Exception to Free Speech, a Movement Under Attack in the U.S. And this, I understand, is the first report of its kind, and it documents the many, many times that Palestinian advocacy has been suppressed, most of it on college campuses. And I wanted to ask you, there seems to be a big uptick in this kind of suppression of Palestine solidarity activists. And my question to you is why?
Yeah, that's a good question. The main reason really is because of the rise in activism that we're seeing, especially in the last couple of years, the last 5 or 10 years even, there's been a distinct rise in activism around the Palestine issue. And that's partly due to the egregious behavior of Israel towards the Palestinians, the successive brutal assaults on Gaza that have gotten a lot of attention. The assault on Gaza last summer was a huge event that really galvanized a lot of opposition to Israel's actions. So with this increase in brutality, we've seen a rise in activism, a rise of solidarity actions. And also since 2005, we've seen the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement grow. And, you know, that's a call from Palestinian civil society to the international community to do something about Israel's behavior when, you know, the diplomacy has gotten them nowhere, and has, in fact, exacerbated the situation for Palestinians on the ground. So all of these factors have led to a rise in activism, especially on campuses. There's a very strong student movement these days on campuses around the country. We see Students for Justice in Palestine groups forming all over the place, and they are engaging in really exciting, creative ways of actions to bring awareness to this issue.
Dima, I understand that the tactics used to silence this kind of advocacy really fall sort of into two parts. We have things that we've seen before to suppress free speech, but we have more serious actions being taken. Can you summarize those?
Yeah, the tactics that we've identified, there are about 9 that we identify in the report, and they range from, false accusations of anti-Semitism and support for terrorism, to administrative sanctions by universities against student groups, to lawsuits and other legal threats, to legislation we're seeing introduced to counter this growing movement, and then to criminal investigations and even prosecutions. So there's a range of tactics being used. And, you know, we have seen some of these tactics used in the past, certainly false accusations of anti-Semitism are nothing new, but there's an intensity to it now that I think is new, and it's partly due to the fact that a lot of Israel advocacy organizations in the United States are now focusing their resources and time and energy on countering the movement and countering the student movement in particular.
Is that because their loss in Iran?
Well, I think there's, that there might be something related, but I think they see this movement as a real threat to Israel's, to the status quo on the Israel-Palestine issue in the U.S. And, you know, I think AIPAC's loss on Iran is maybe one more factor in kind of losing ground here. But, you know, certainly they feel that their position in this country, the unconditional support for Israel, may be threatened. So we're seeing a lot of resources being put into these attacks, and you know, we heard Sheldon Adelson promising tens of millions of dollars towards lawfare, towards legislation and lawsuits against this movement, among other things. So there's a real focus on attacking this movement.
I understand, Dima, there also have been instances of official denunciation from institutions. And I believe the report documents that sometimes that's in response to external pressure. How problematic do you think that is?
Well, official denunciations, I mean, we're seeing universities, for example, outright denouncing the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement after the American Studies Association endorsed the academic boycott of Israel at the end of 2013. Several hundred university administrators, presidents, and otherwise, you know, denounced the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, or the academic boycott itself, publicly. And they have said things comparing SJP's activities to the KKK and to other racial incidents on campuses, things like that. That's what we mean by official denunciations. And while these incidents may seem relatively minor, what we're seeing is that they are, first of all, in response to pressure from outside groups claiming that BDS is anti-Semitic, that BDS is discriminatory against Jewish people, and, you know, encouraging the universities to punish and denounce SJP's activities and this kind of activism. But the second troubling thing about it is that it inevitably is leading to more actions by the universities to suppress student and even faculty speech. So, you know, we then see SJP groups coming under a huge amount of scrutiny from their administrators, being called into meetings to explain their events, to give them scripts of what their, you know, mock checkpoint is going to be saying. They're imposing security fees on student events because there are complaints about them. So it leads to a lot of this kind of these kinds of bureaucratic barriers, what we call bureaucratic barriers, that make it more difficult for students to organize, that put a lot of pressure on academics, on faculty who speak out about these issues. So even if those official denunciations are themselves not legally actionable, we see them result in a lot of pressure on student groups that really chills speech, that has an effect on their ability to speak out about this issue. And that, you know, is scary when you have, you know, your dean or your president saying that what you do is wrong and denouncing it in other ways.
We're speaking with attorney Dima Khalidi, who wrote the report, The Palestine Exception to Free Speech, a Movement Under Attack in the U.S. The report was put together by Palestine Legal, where Dima works, and by the Center for Constitutional Rights. And there's a map in the report that shows incidences from January 1st of 2014 to June 30th of this year, were 292 incidences, and 101 of them occurred in California. Dima, why so much action in California?
Well, we've seen quite a big focus on California schools in particular. And this is actually, you know, it dates back to over a decade ago. We saw a lot of activism happening on California schools, in California schools over the last decade. And we've also seen a couple of organizations focusing on attacking activism happening at these schools. So we saw an organization called the AMCA Initiative arise to explicitly combat Palestine activism on these campuses, focusing on California. And the AMCA Initiative is really is behind a lot of efforts to censor students and faculty. The AMCA Initiative founder is a Hebrew lecturer at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and you know she's responsible, for example, for attacking a tour by Ilan Pappe, an Israeli historian, on California State University campuses. She tried to get those events canceled. She's behind Title VI complaints against University of California schools. This effort to use the Civil Rights Act to claim that universities are tolerating an anti-Semitic hostile environment when they allow Palestine activism to happen. This is a trend. We've seen several such complaints, three against University of California campuses. And they, you know, they're attacking things like lectures and film screenings and protests and saying that because this activism is happening, Jewish students that support Israel are feeling uncomfortable to the point that it amounts to discrimination and harassment against them. And a lot of these have failed. All of the ones that we've seen targeting Palestine activism have failed because the Department of Education, where these complaints are lodged, has said, you know, this is speech about a matter of public concern, and you know the First Amendment applies at these schools. And just because people feel uncomfortable with this activism doesn't mean that it's a discrimination or harassment under the law. So, you know, even when we see these kinds of dismissals of cases, you know, a lot of these complaints were under investigation for years and years, and they cause a real chilling effect, and they cause the universities again to increase their scrutiny of Palestine activism. So California has definitely been a focus for a lot of these kinds of attacks.
I heard Stephen Salaita speak, and I see that his case, now famous case, is mentioned in your report. And one of the things that Stephen was discussing last night was a new initiative called Canary. And I wanted you to comment on that, if you could.
Yeah, Canary Mission is a website put up by an anonymous. We don't know who's behind it. And what it does is profile over 100 now, mainly student activists as well as, you know, academics and other folks who are involved in advocacy for Palestinian rights. And it has the explicit intent of denying people or getting employers to deny these people who are profiled employment to ruin their reputations, et cetera. So it's a very McCarthyist kind of attempt to blacklist individuals who are engaged in this activism, to accuse them of being anti-Semitic as well as supporting terrorism. So it tries to connect, for example, Students for Justice in Palestine with Hamas, which is a designated terrorist organization in the United States, without any basis for that kind of connection. But, you know, just by insinuating this connection, it really puts these individuals in a place where they have to defend themselves against these kinds of baseless accusations. So it's a really troubling development, but it is also a common tactic that we're seeing, this kind of surveillance and blacklisting. We've seen a lot of cases in which student events and professors' lectures are recorded, and you know, people taking pictures of activists and creating dossiers on them. So this is a continuing tactic that is being used to intimidate activists. And, you know, we get a lot of calls from concerned people saying, you know, I don't want this profile of me up there. It's not true. It's, you know, damaging. You know, it's a troubling development, but it's not a new tactic.
Dima, you're there at Palestine Legal in Chicago. Can you tell us, like, what's a typical day for your office?
We have attorneys in New York and California as well, but our work consists of, you know, we have an intake system, so we respond to requests for help, for advice from activists all over the country. We also do Know Your Rights training, so we go to universities and talk to other advocacy groups about what they might expect, what kind of backlash to expect, and how to confront it, and what legal rights they have in different circumstances. And then we do a lot of advocacy work. So, you know, this report is really an effort to bring this issue to light and to bring some awareness to what's really happening on campuses. So our work really ranges from kind of direct representation to broader advocacy work to building relationships with activists on the ground and making sure that they're prepared for what might come at them.
Dima, we just have a few minutes remaining, but in addition to Stephen Salida's case, can you mention any notable victories that you're aware of in the last year or so?
I mentioned the Title VI cases. I think those are huge victories when you have government agencies saying there's a First Amendment here, and you know we can't punish political speech. So that's a big victory, I think, when those dismissals came down. We don't have a lot of cases that are in court necessarily, but when we push back against lawsuit threats, for example, and a lawsuit never happens, I think that's a victory. And that's what happened against the American Studies Association after their boycott. An organization called Shurat Hadin, the Israel Law Center, which is behind a lot of litigation and lawsuit threats, threatened the ASA with a lawsuit. And, you know, we pushed back and said this lawsuit is completely baseless. And if you bring it, then, you know, you're going to get challenged here. So things like that, I think, are important. Another example is at Pitzer College in California, one of the Claremont colleges. A Students for Justice in Palestine group wanted to put up a mock wall. And the administration said, you have to go get this approved by the aesthetics committee, kind of Orwellian concept. And the aesthetics committee, of course, rejected their proposal to put up the wall. And we pushed back against that. We said, you know, it's California. The First Amendment applies here. You cannot discriminate against this kind of speech activity based on its content. And the university ended up letting them put up the wall. So, you know, we have to continue pushing back against these efforts at censorship. At Pitzer, you know, it was a result of, again, complaints that this wall was anti-Semitic and that it would create, you know, a problem on campus. So we have to push back against these pressure campaigns to get universities and other institutions to cancel events, to punish students, et cetera. And I think we have willing audiences in university administrations and in other places when, you know, they're under siege a lot of the time to engage in actions that very well might violate the First Amendment. And we have to remind them that of their responsibilities and of the fact that universities are meant to be places where, you know, this vigorous debate occurs, where you are made uncomfortable, where you're challenged, where your views are challenged. you know, just because something is divisive, this is a common complaint.
Thank you very much. And before we let you go, how can people get a hold of the report that you initiated, The Palestine Exception to Free Speech, a Movement Under Attack in the U.S.? If somebody who's in our listening audience wants to get a hold of this report, how do they do that?
You can go to palestinelegal.org, The Palestine Exception, and our report is available there along with other resources. Thank you. Thank you both for having me.
Thanks, Dima. Thanks. Always a pleasure.
Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Take care.
So long.
Bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.